This is a production of Cornell University.
It was 22 years ago this week. We held the first U.S. Open at Bethpage Black, and I had the pleasure of being on the crew as a much younger man back then. But of course, this was during the height of the Tiger Woods, period of dominance that, you know, Scottie Scheffler may be going through. So we start them out young. Ashley Binkley is a golf course superintendent in Canada and has these one lovely kid who she's been showing on Twitter forever. And, you know, you just love seeing this walking out there. And of course, on a sad note, there were a lot of passings. I think for those of us, again, that have dogs, losing them is really hard. And I think it's great that people share these things, especially for men who sometimes have a tough time expressing emotions around these things. Animals seem to be a place where men have figured out how to at least express some emotions. And all of us that have dogs know that. And so, Carl, I'm going to take the weather for a little bit, and I'm going to set you up for us to transition to Rich. So just a little bit about the weather as we normally do. Soil's cool, right? As we've seen a cooling pattern on the weather, we're also seeing some cooling happening in the soils, right? It was really pushing warm, and really the only places that are warm left are down where Rich is and along the Metro New York area along the coast. Oh, let me see. Sorry about that. And of course, that represents how much it was cooler than normal last week. We've been on a warming trend over in general, but cooler than normal means it's been cooler than we'd expect it to be over the last 30 years, particularly inland, warmer to the north and a little bit more to the south. Now, this is allowing us to still be ahead of last year. And I think for people that go year to year, seeing how far we are ahead of last year, but also recognizing we're right around normal. Most of the region, based on the 30-year average, is normal. And I think climate change makes these things a little bit more difficult to really interpret and get a feel for, right? Because as we've been warming so significantly over the last two decades, you know, what's normal is not as easy to understand as maybe it used to be. It's very interesting. We had our conference call this morning and we had people talking about how dry it was. And then all of a sudden, boom, we had people talking about how wet it was. And I think, what you see is this widespread drying. If you drew a line from Pittsburgh to Boston, you'd see in a couple hundred mile diameter of that, width of that, you'd see a really big dry trend the last week. But other places, almost everybody else got about an inch of rain. So there was a real split in the moisture across the region. Now, Carl, here's something I want to talk to you about. This is a loamy soil. This is the lawn watering tool. This is a loamy soil down in the Metro New York area over the last month, right? So I think I put the pin in Central Park or something like that, right? So I'm looking at this thing, and I got a normal native soil like Zach Holm would have at Central Park, right? So I'm looking at this thing. And my first thought is, I'm not sure I would have watered once in the last month, because while I did have, you know, let me get the pencil here for those watching us, I did have 3 days where I was in some severe, as we're defining it now, stress, another day where it touched it, maybe a couple of days were in it, a couple of days more a minute. But what I've noticed, Carl, is I'm always coming out of it. Right. Yeah. I'm not really persisting in a way. And it looks like I'm going to come out of it again this coming week. Now, moisture is the conversation as we reach the summer solstice, right? When the sun is highest in the sky and we get the most ET. When you're looking at this, are you seeing what I'm seeing, that maybe I wouldn't have irrigated my lawn in the last month?
Yeah, I think I agree with you, Frank. I haven't seen the visible stress like that may be indicated on this model. And part of that is the model is based on these maximum allowable deficits. So basically, you know, you have your field capacity, and then if you drop that down 70%, in theory, that's when we might expect some stress. But I think our model early in the season is probably over predicting that stress. Like, mm-hmm. We had a nice amount of moisture this whole spring. Like you've said on our conference call this morning, man, it's felt wet, right? And maybe part of that is the root depth is really deep too. So we have we have our rooting depth from the spring rooting. So our roots can access a larger column of water. Mm-hmm. And when we get into this, you know, quote unquote, severe plant stress phase in the model, mm-hmm. hey, maybe our roots are actually deeper than this model is estimating. Mm-hmm. So we're not actually seeing stress when we predict it. Now, if we pick up this hot and dry spell that we're going to have, move it into late August or September when we've lost rooting depth, mm-hmm. that's when I think we'll start to see this severe stress mm-hmm. actually play out versus
it's very now, interesting.
We have more
of that. And because, you know, the soil moisture thing is the fascinating part, and it's not just soil moisture, but it's soil where that rooting is. Okay, so this is good to know, because on the model, if you go to the website, you'll actually see if you were setting it and forgetting it starting in May 1st, you would have put a fair amount of water down already, 4 inches or so in the last month, and really not needed it. And that's the kind of thing where I think we're trying to drive here with this model. Now, as Carl mentioned, and we know the heat stress is going to be building, this is the 18th, so you can see it's coming across the region next week. This is where we have high temperatures that persist and high humidity that persists in the evening. Now, as soon as you start talking about high temperature and high humidity, Carl, we're talking about diseases, but it looks like brown patch in particular is confined to the southern end of the region. Now, I know you've got a rant about this with regard to pesticide use, and this will be a perfect setup for our guest today. Go ahead, Carl.
Yeah. So one of the things, when I first started working with you, Frank, I'd go to these conferences and I wanted to learn about how we apply pesticides, you know, disease life cycles. And I was in a seminar at the GCSAA show, and Bruce Clark was going through all the cultural practices for, you know, dollar spot prevention or brown patch or anthracnose, and spends a lot of time on the cultural practices, the irrigation, the fertility. And there were no questions from the group. And then finally, at the end, where we get to chemical control, oh baby, the questions come flooding in, and I was marking them down. I'm like, oh my God, there's 20 questions on chemicals and none on the cultural control. And just, I think that sort of mentality is what people end up sort of getting into in the turf industry. And it makes sense, right? We need pesticides. Frank, you studied this at Bethpage Black. When we manage golf courses, this is a picture of, I think the blue or the green course here, but we need pesticides in some quantity to manage golf courses. That's just how it is in at least in Long Island. The amount of pesticides we need, that changes based on our expectations, right? And when we did some work with the guys at Wisconsin, that was the main question, was what drives overall pesticide use on golf courses? Is it the soils? Is it the turf grass varieties? Is it the growing conditions? And what we found was it's the budget. And in effect, it's the expectations. When you expect more at a golf course, when your members pay $50,000 to get initiated into that golf course, they're going to expect a blemish-free golf course, and you will use more pesticides. So when you spend more, you spray more. That's the governor of pesticide use. And specifically, when we look at the parts of the golf course that make up sort of the majority of that pesticide use, it's the large areas. It's the fairways, large-scale rough applications that will really drive that overall total. And it's interesting, when we look at pesticide records from a mom and pop course, the greens are not a whole lot different from some of those high-end places, but they don't spray the fairways, and a high-end place sprays the fairways 10 times or 12 times. And that's really what shoots up those pesticide numbers. Now, when we zoomed out, we got pesticide records from different areas of the country. We expected different sort of levels of pesticide use. And when you look at Texas or Florida or the Midwest, compared to us up here in the Northeast, man, pesticide use wasn't that different across the United States. And we expected more from the climates, right? Hey, maybe different climates, different temperatures, different growing season lengths would change pesticide use. And in the US, it's about the same. But when we got records from other countries, courses in Denmark or Norway or the UK, wow, they use a lot less pesticides. And that's probably not because of climate. It's probably because of the regulatory climate, right? They have access to way fewer pesticides. We're talking easily an order of magnitude fewer pesticides, and that restricts their ability to apply them. And you and Ben talked on the show last week about some of the regulations here in New York, the birds and bees bill, and neonic bans. And
yeah,
I think our turf industry gets really sort of defensive about those. And last week, you guys talked really well about the science behind, hey, maybe in turf, neonics aren't that bad, but in seed-coated treatments, yeah, there is a high risk to pollinators. And it's tough when the science isn't sort of leading the legislative approach. But often we'll get defensive whether the science is leading or not. And you know, the Spider-Man meme, you're pointing. Our industry likes to point the fingers at, hey, we're doing good. What about that one over there? And so we've looked at this a little bit. You know, the ag will, you know, we'll point to ag. Ag will point to golf courses as excessive users. And we looked at some pesticide records as part of that research a couple years ago. And man, golf course turf is about equal with grape production in terms of our pesticide use. Apples, see, we see more pesticide use in apple orchards and potatoes. Holy smokes, paint it white, sleep at night. We talk about that in turf. They use chlorothalonil a bunch in potato production. So we can do some of that, but I think what I come back to is one of my mentors, and Frank, you spent a lot of time with her, Jennifer Grant, would really always just look inward, right? And instead of pointing the finger at other people, really asking the question, she'd be very direct with superintendent. Why do you do that? Do you need that? Like, why did you spray that thing? And if someone couldn't explain themselves, she'd be like, well, what the heck, right? Why did you do that? If you can't explain why you did it, do you really need that? And I think this is a good question to ask. And I ask this all the time of myself is, you know, do I need to be doing this? And if I can come up with a good reason and I can rationalize it, when we talk about, and you guys will talk about disease control probably here in a bit, you need to sort of be able to diagnose the disease. Maybe you send it to Rich, and Rich says, yes, you have X, Y, and Z. You need to treat this. Hey, I need that. But when you can't really sort of rationalize that, and that's the great part about Jen and her IPM background was hey, if you can't rationalize it, why are you wasting your time on it? And was that time and money better spent on something else?
Well, here, yeah, and I think, Carl, this is really the perfect transition to the conversation when we talk about why, because this just, you know, everybody learns this in some form of pathology, that you have a pathogen, a susceptible host, and all you're waiting for is the suitable environment, unless, you know, you expect something to blow in like a cutworm, an armyworm, or a gray leaf spot that blows in maybe. It's waiting for the host too, but in general, you're waiting for the conducive environment. And of course, we talked about this, Carl, as you said in the past, and Rich, you were involved in this research many years ago when we were using your records and other diagnostic records to just determine when are samples coming in, what kinds of trends are we seeing, what does our model say? This was back in early days. You know, we were again much younger men. So we've seen a shift in seasonal things for sure. But just to bring you in, Rich, I don't know, everybody knows you're a biker riding your how many miles? 1,000, 10,000 miles a year? How many are you doing now a year?
Yeah, about around 10,000 a year. And that's, I'm down now. I'm old. I need a little more rest.
And of course, you just attended the Dead at the Sphere, which I know you're avidly enjoying live music, but at the same time, I noticed is also when you were a younger man, you're well supported by Sabrina in the diagnostic lab. So big shout out to all the diagnostic people. And here's our questions for today, Rich. All right, we've been working together a really long time, right? And I'm sort of curious about the trends over the last 20 years. And you know, you are dependent on samples coming in, so people understand that. And of course, you know, your institution, Murphy and Clark, did that anthracnose work many years ago. And I'm sure, you know, you were getting a lot more samples before they identified you got to put a little bit more nitrogen, you got to watch your growth regulators, you got to sand a little bit. Do you get as many anthracnose samples? How much have your diagnostics changed based on some of the research that's been done to maybe help guys identify things themselves a little bit better? Let's talk about that.
Well, it's a great question. And anthracnose is an excellent example of how research can solve problems. You
Sure.
know, we used to, I guess it was 2001, the number of anthracnose samples that I would get was about 36% of the total turf samples. And, you know, it was somewhere around 200 a year. Last season, we got 14 anthracnose samples. You know, so it pretty much wrecked the business for us as diagnosticians, because if you follow the guidelines, you know, and it was a decade or so of research by a whole bunch of really good pathologists. It eliminates the risk for that particular disease, and we just don't get the samples now.
Okay. So research undermines your business model, which I think is a good point to remember. But I'm also interested maybe in what you see with the superintendents that do submit samples or that you speak with, because you're on the road chatting a fair amount. And, you know, Carl and I, and you've been involved in our forecast models here at Cornell. We as Carl has said, they're all wrong, but they're useful. I'm wondering how much you see about that. And also, how much is there more spraying going on than there used to be? And is that related to different products, or is it related to being a little bit more averse to risk? You know, like what we've talked about recently, that how people have decided they need to spray preventatively 8 times for Pythium root rot. What kind of behavioral changes have you seen among superintendents over the last bunch of years?
Well, that's a great question. And a lot of times I think that those of us in this side of the business are more like psychiatrists or psychologists than pathologists. Guys, depending on where they are, and we talk about the higher end and bigger budgets mean more sprays, are still spraying quite a bit. You know, I remember in the heyday of anthracnose that many superintendents would spray on 4 or 5 day intervals even. You know, not knowing they needed to fertilize and that would have solved their problem. It's not uncommon to see weekly fungicide treatments on greens and teas today. It's interesting. I don't think they spray more, but the risk aversion is higher, you know, moving from the high end to the low end. Even the mid-range and lower end guys are getting pressure for higher quality grass, so they spray more. And then, you know, to kind of roll this into, there's a lot more chemistry. There's a lot of chemicals now. You know, it's remarkable, really, what I've seen come to market in the last 30 years that we didn't have when I started.
And they're maybe softer and not as persistent, and that might be why we're spraying weekly.
Yeah, maybe. I still think, you know, if you're spraying on 14 days, that's pretty darn good coverage, you know? So you don't need a fungicide that knocks the crap out of a fungus, you know, for maybe 21 or 28 days before it recovers its growth. You don't need to spray it every 7 days. Mm-hmm. So even the most risk averse person at 14 days is still covering really well.
All right, so let's stay on the Pythium root rot thing, because this has really been in my craw, and I know I banter with Carl all the time about this, and I think it's come up recently. Is there a thought among pathologists that maybe we shouldn't be spraying for Pythium root rot? I mean, listen, let's make sure everybody understands what we're talking about. When you have saturated root zones and you have stressed turf to begin with, cut low, you know, a lot of traffic. You get these wet conditions. It doesn't even have to be hot, I don't think, right, Rich? You'll get Pythium root rot in those anaerobic conditions, right?
Yeah. And temperature doesn't matter at all. I mean, going back to Eric Nelson, you know, in 1990, you know, he was talking about pathogenicity at 40 degrees, you know, and causing root infections with some of the same pathogens that cause Pythium blight on the foliage, you know, at 80 degrees. So, you know, super saturated soils, poor internal drainage, extra rain, all of that creates a condition for this or these That's organisms because right. they're algae, you know, they're not really true fungi. But, you know, I don't think everybody needs to be spraying. I think you need to be fixing your drainage or your irrigation protocol or, you know, something like that. I think you're going to get more bang from your buck from that than starting to spray at 50 degrees or 55 degrees and spraying all season.
But you're seeing it more and more.
We see a more preventive Pythium root rot applications. And I think, you know, down south, you know, North Carolina, South Carolina, you know, maybe there's more call for it. and some of the programs that come out of the Southern researchers might work well down there, but maybe be excessive up here.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So I don't, I'm going to go a little bit further with this. They are more risk averse. They seem even at the mid and low level, everybody's expecting higher quality conditions, right? So they're having to spray more. I'm wondering, just my sarcastic view, as you know from working with me a long time, I was very surprised with the rash of nematode concerns we had years ago that seemed to be well-timed with the release of new nematicides from two big chemical companies. I thought that was a very interesting correlation causation situation going on. And I'm wondering about the regular visits that our distributor reps make to our clientele, maybe saying, boy, you should probably get that Pythium root rot. I'm not suggesting impropriety, but I'm suggesting more, is it your thought maybe superintendents are barraged a little bit with these things that might be a concern, and that drives their use a little bit?
Yes, I agree.
Be careful now, because
yeah, I know I'm trying.
There
not
might
to,
be two
not,
people listening.
I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, but yeah, there's a lot. There's a lot of that. Look, there's two things I see. You know, new product and you know, the marketing push for the new products, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing is superintendents who are so busy with multiple tasks, you know, personnel problems, greens committee, you know, basically saying to the sales reps, just sell me what you think I need, you know, mm-hmm. and that way they don't have to really think about it in the way we would want them to from an IPM, you know, from Jennifer Grant's standpoint. Mm-hmm. You know, and so they get into programs that may have been worked out by a research scientist that are picked up by the companies, and they might not need any of it, you know, and so,
okay. So. All right. So we'll end this part with being thoughtful, right? And as we're more thoughtful, there appears to be some new things on the horizon. What is this new pathogen from John Inguijato at UConn that I know you're talking about, that you've been talking about? And also this morning you commented, as you hang out with molecular biologists like Ming Yi, your new turf grass pathologist who replaced Dr. Clark, they're sort of throwing a wrench in the whole pathogen ID thing. So do we really know what we thought we know, or we don't know what we don't know anymore?
Well, it's become more confusing because, you know, now with the ability to sequence the genes of these organisms, we're starting to see differences, you know, and so it was just to start with a new pathogen that John's looking at, and that's new. We can't name it. John suggested a name, and Ming Yi did some work with the same pathogen, and they said that the matches they're getting aren't close enough to know what this is. So it's something new, you know?
Okay, so this is good because we don't have a lot of time left, and I know this can be a very lengthy conversation. Is it academic, or are these species potentially going to relate to the need for different control measures?
Well, there's two answers for that. Depending on which one, it could be academic. You know, John's pathogen looks a lot like brown ring patch, you know, or wadia patch. And we know DMI fungicides work really well for wadia. And DMI fungicides, John said, to name one, Maxtema, works really well. You know, so maybe we just realize it's a new pathogen because John looked a little closer one time, okay. You know?
Okay.
So that's that. The other issue is with these root infecting patch diseases. You know, we both know, of course, that was having trouble with their summer patch control.
That's right.
And I would always suggest to them that it was timing. But what we found was it was a closely related pathogen that wasn't Magnaporthiopsis, this slopiomyces.
Oh, God.
And, uh, And so that pathogen has been implicated as the cause of take-all and bentgrass, you know, in Canada. And so we're, what we're finding is that pathogen grows at a lower soil temperature, right? So we are missing the timing, but we should have started at 55 degrees, not 65 degrees. And so we're finding that in poa, we're finding it in bentgrass. We're also finding this Magnaporthiopsis myeri that's supposed to be in fine fescues in poa on putting greens that are telling me the same story, right? Whoa. So figuring out exactly which one of these, and Ming Yi says to me, he says, if they get good control at 65 degrees, then it's Magnaporthiopsis. If they don't, tell them to start at 55 degrees. Oh, no.
We've bantered
around just calling it like the summer patch syndrome, because there's multiple pathogens here and we still have a little bit to learn.
This is great. But on the other hand, coming back full circle, it seems like diagnostics are still going to play an important role, because we're going to have new pathogens, right? And if people become thoughtful, right, and are interested, you know, they can take samples. Do I have Pythium root rot that I have to worry about here? You're going to find Pythium everywhere. There is still a role for people to send samples in. No one's sending you good turf. No. But if they're having trouble with their root pathogens, this seems to be something that remains difficult to diagnose, that it'd be really good to get it in professional hands, wouldn't you say?
I would say. And you know, we can look at it. And you know, I'm a classically trained pathologist. You know, I was trained 30-something years ago. Yeah. So I look at morphology and all the old school stuff, and to partner with the guys that have the new technology. You know, so what we're trying to do is bring in some of these newer technologies in order to separate this stuff. And so we're going to start offering molecular characterization of these root pathogens through the lab. You know, the problem is, you know, I can tell you in like 20 minutes, takes Ming Yi a month, you know, to get to isolate and do all that work. So, you know,
but that'll change, right? They'll develop assays, I would imagine, over time, won't they?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's stuff that's quicker, you know, and I think once they get a clear picture of what we're looking at, then they'll start working on speed. And, you know, in my lab, it's always about quick and dirty. What can you fast? Right. And it'll get to that, you know, because in other crop systems and other pathogens, they're already there. So we're going to get there too.
All right. Well, Carl, do we have anything for our fine guest here? We have no gifts. This ain't The Price is Right. So all we got is questions.
The gift is just being here with you guys.
The points are made up. What is it? The points are made up and the scores don't matter.
That's right.
Rich, one question I had was, I don't see a whole lot of people testing things on their nursery areas or their, you know, skip areas, check plots. I don't see a whole lot of that. And I wonder, how often do you recommend that for people who are spraying a lot of things, and maybe you'll look at their program and go, I don't know if you need this. Do people play around enough on areas to the side that they have experimental areas? Dan Donnelly comes to mind as a guy who's done this with varieties and root zones.
Yeah, well, you know what? You see a little bit of that, but mostly the risk aversion. You know, nobody's willing to even
throw down a piece of paper. Spot.
Yeah, right. It's like, you know, and it's we've been teaching this sort of stuff, you know, treatment evaluations forever. You know, we're teaching modeling, we're teaching mindful decision, precision applications, and underneath it all, I think is this: the risk averse, high salary has to be perfect, and it's still driving everything guys in the field.
Yeah, that top-down stress is certainly what
Well, it's a cultural thing. I mean, yeah. what we're talking about here is a cultural thing. It's the expectations are human derived. Science and the climate don't determine expectations. It's not a first principle. It's humans deciding that needs to be perfect and their willingness to pay for it. I think that's the other part of this. None of this is happening if there's not willingness to pay for it. So it also is the economics that golf is doing pretty good, especially golf these days. But I even see it in school grounds. You know, they're willing to spend money on synthetic turf. More grounds and landscapes want to be manicured, not just groomed. And sometimes they worry about chemicals. Sometimes they don't. All right, Carl, are we there? We're there. The fastest.
We're there. Season 5 of the Cornell Turf Show is in the books, and maybe next season we'll focus on people and not grass, because that's what it always comes down to. Frank, it always comes down to people. As much as you don't like interacting with people, it ends up there. So thank you, everyone, for those who've listened live, who've watched the videos, who listen on the podcast. Thank you a bunch.
Yeah,
we will definitely be back.
Thanks, Carl. See you, Rich. Good seeing you.
Thank you. Talk to you next week.
Rich.
See you.
This has been a production of Cornell University on the web at cornell.edu.